content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading from the June 15th, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. Quick editorial note, I think we're going to get two readings out of this issue, so we will do some of the more timely news articles this week and then pick up some others next week. The cover drawing on this issue has Donald Trump. He is dressed in royal regalia, sitting on a throne. He's got a big blonde wig on and a throne. A crown. He's got a scepter in one hand and raising a finger. And he even has a necklace with big letters MAGA, standing for that Make America Great Again. And in fact, the title is A Royal Decree. Trump's claim he cannot be questioned or obstruct justice and can pardon himself. And that, in fact, is our first main story, and we will start right there. Trump's assertion of unlimited authority. What happened? In a confidential 20-page memo, President Trump's legal team told special counsel Robert Mueller that the president has limitless authority over federal investigations and thus cannot be charged with obstructing justice. The January 2018 document, obtained by the New York Times, asserts that the president could at any time terminate the inquiry into Russian interference in the 2016 election or pardon anyone under investigation. It also contends that Trump cannot be subpoenaed and that submitting to an interview would demean the office of the presidency, which must remain sacred and above the fray of shifting political winds and gamesmanship. In a stunning revelation, the letter acknowledged the president dictated Donald Trump Jr.'s misleading July 17th statement regarding his meeting with a Russian informant at Trump Tower during the 2016 campaign, something the president, his press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and his attorneys had previously repeatedly denied. That statement said the meeting was primarily about adoptions of Russian children, neglecting to mention that Russians connected to the Kremlin had promised damaging information about Hillary Clinton. This is the reason you don't let the president testify, Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani told ABC News. Our recollection keeps changing. Trump took his frustrations to Twitter, declaring an absolute right to pardon myself and slamming the investigation as a Democrat-led, never-ending witch hunt that's totally unconstitutional. The president also tweeted that he would have nominated someone other than Jeff Sessions as attorney general had he known Sessions would recuse himself from overseeing the Russia investigation. Trump has repeatedly pressured Sessions to reverse that recusal, the New York Times reported, requests that Mueller has made part of his obstruction investigation. What the editorial said, like kings and emperors of ages past, Trump not only thinks he is above the law, he thinks he is the law, said the Los Angeles Times. Trump is warning Mueller that any attempt to prosecute him, his aides, or his family is a waste of time, and he'll just pardon everyone, including himself, and move on. Sadly, this arrogance is not surprising, said the New York Times. Trump has long been drawn to the monarchical grandeur of the office, but has little understanding of the constitutional limits to presidential power. Even more troubling, he's now accusing Mueller of meddling in the November midterms by refusing to end his investigation. This sets up a Trump claim that if Democrats take control of the House, the election was rigged and invalid. Trump's lawyers make many highly debatable assertions, said the National Review, but their memo got two major points correct. Despite collecting voluminous documentary evidence and testimony, Mueller has yet to present a viable criminal case against the president, nor has he justified the extraordinary measure of seeking the president's testimony. Absent a smoking gun, Mueller should wrap up the obstruction probe of the president rather than keep looking for one. What the columnist said. Trump's lawyers have made an extreme and outrageous argument, said Indira Lakshman in the Boston Globe. Despite jaw-dropping evidence of Trump campaign contacts with the Russians and an ongoing cover-up, the president's legal team is insisting that the president has absolute power to end the inquiry for any reason. This is reminiscent of Richard Nixon's claim that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal. And King Louis XIV's notorious decree, l'état, c'est moi, or I am the state. This memo is essentially an admission of guilt, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Trump's own attorneys concede he lied about meetings between his campaign and Russians, fired people investigating his aides, and can't be trusted to answer questions. Their legal defense, none of that matters because Trump has absolute unchecked power. Actually, Trump's lawyers are right, said Michael Graham in CBSNews.com. The president has more important things to do than preparing for an interview with Mueller, especially with a majority of Americans considering the Russia investigation to be politically motivated. The public wants the president focused on the economy, trade, and national security. Why shouldn't Trump issue a pardon today and move on with being president? Besides, Trump's strategy is modeled after the one that worked for Bill Clinton, said Byron York in Spectator USA. The Clinton White House relentlessly attacked independent counsel Ken Starr and accused him of presiding over a partisan witch hunt. With Trump supporters increasingly confident, the big collusion charges just aren't coming. The president has the upper hand. For now, he might, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. But Trump's assertion of near dictatorial powers indicates how weak and precarious his position has become. Senate investigators have already shown that just before Trump Jr. met with the Russians, he made or received a phone call from a blocked number. Was the call from Donald Sr., who had a blocked Trump Tower number? Mueller knows. Based on the president's growing hysteria, the special counsel knows a lot more than the public, that the public does not. What next? If Mueller decides to test Trump's assertions in court, said Abigail Tracy in VanityFair.com, the president is likely to lose. Most constitutional scholars and legal experts dismiss the president's insistence he cannot obstruct justice, and the president suggests that Trump can indeed be subpoenaed. As for pardoning himself, that has never been tested, but Republicans are already warning against it. House Speaker Paul Ryan said Trump should obviously not pardon himself, adding, "No one is above the law." To get Trump's testimony, Mueller might not even need to take the president to court, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. When Starr subpoenaed Clinton in 1998, the president backed down and agreed to a four-hour interview at the White House, avoiding the dangerous and diminishing spectacle of testifying before a grand jury. If I were advising Mueller, I'd suggest it's subpoena time. And we'll read a second main story. Trump's tariffs ignite a trade war with allies. The Trump administration sparked a trade war with America's closest allies this week after it imposed steep tariffs on imports from Canada, Mexico, and the European Union, which immediately retaliated with targeted tariffs on U.S. products. Trump's tariffs, 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum, were first announced in March. But the administration gave several key allies temporary exemptions while they negotiated deals with the U.S. When those talks failed to make rapid progress, Trump ordered the duties imposed. The U.S. has been taken advantage of for many decades on trade, the president said. Those days are over. Canada, Mexico, and the EU retaliated quickly, announcing nearly $20 billion worth of import duties in total on U.S. goods, including pork, steel, bourbon, peanut butter, and orange juice. Some prominent Republicans attacked Trump's tariffs as wrong-headed. "This is dumb," said Senator Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska. "You don't treat allies the same way you treat opponents." Trump insisted that the tariffs were needed to protect U.S. national security interests, a claim that Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called insulting to the thousands of Canadians who had fought and died alongside American GIs from World War II to Afghanistan. The dispute all but guarantees that Trump will get a frosty reception at the G7 summit in Canada this week, which will be attended by leaders from many of the nations hit with tariffs. What the editorial said: "This trade war will put Trump's solid economic record at risk," said the Wall Street Journal. "American firms that rely on complex cross-border supply chains will have to swallow the tariff costs, and so they'll likely hire fewer workers and pay lower wages. As for Trump's claim that the duties are vital for national security, that's nonsense. Canadian steel and aluminum are integral to U.S. national defense. His duties will make our planes and tanks more expensive, giving Russia an advantage in international arms sales. Brilliant." The tariffs were met with cheers in the industrial Midwest, said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. But those same states are full of farmers who will bear the brunt of their retaliation. Mexico, the second largest export market for U.S. pork, slapped a 20% duty on U.S. pork, which could mean U.S. farmers will lose business to other, cheaper foreign producers. It's not just farmers who will feel the hurt. One study suggests a trade war could cost the average U.S. family $210 a year, wiping out most benefits of the tax bill passed last December. The GOP could end up paying for that pain in the midterms. What the columnist said: "What's the modern case for tariffs?" asked James Fallows in TheAtlantic.com. "They're a useful tool when you want to coerce another country into changing its behavior. Yet Canada, Mexico, and the EU aren't doing anything about steel or aluminum that the U.S. could plausibly call wrong or unfair. Sure, they sell a lot of metal here, but that's no more unfair than the U.S. selling a lot of soybeans to Japan or airliners to China. If the goal is to somehow reduce trade deficits, these tariffs will be laughably ineffective." "There's one consequence we can be sure of," said Bonnie Glazer in the New York Times. "The tariffs will make it harder to counter China. Trump is playing into Beijing's portrayal of the U.S. as a unilateral disruptor and undermining the free trade system the U.S. has led since the end of World War II. As an ambitious, rising China promotes its model of authoritarian, state-run capitalism around the world, the U.S. can fight back only through coordination with allies, the very allies Trump is alienating. It's not enough for lawmakers to criticize Trump. They need to take back control of trade policy," said Clive Crook in Bloomberg.com. "The Constitution vests Congress with the power to regulate international commerce, and Senator Bob Corker introduced a bill this week to constrain the president's tariffs power. Yet few Republicans and Democrats have so far voiced support for the legislation. If lawmakers do nothing as the trade war escalates, destroying thousands of American jobs in the process, it would be Congress' most consequential dereliction of duty so far." Our controversy of the week is titled Gay Wedding Cake, What the Supreme Court's Ruling Means. If this decision were a wedding cake, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate.com, it would leave everyone wanting more. This week, the Supreme Court released its long-awaited ruling in the case of Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Rather than tackle the central issue, though, whether a claim of religious liberty entitled a Christian baker to refuse to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding, the court effectively punted. In a surprisingly lopsided 7-2 decision, the justices ruled for the baker, Jack Phillips, but on the narrow grounds that members of the Civil Rights Commission had verbally disparaged Phillips' religious beliefs when they said that religion had been used to justify all kinds of discrimination throughout history, including slavery. These hostile comments, Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote for the majority, violated the Constitution's guarantee that laws be applied in a manner that is neutral toward religion. The LGBT community and its allies should still be relieved, said Christian Farias in nymag.com. The religious right was seeking a blanket shield to discriminate. Kennedy instead explicitly reaffirmed the rights and dignity of gay persons and wrote that as a general rule, businesses may not deny service to gays by claiming a religious objection. By handing a partial victory to each side, Kennedy managed to have his cake and eat it. The ruling wasn't nearly as narrow as legal progressives would have you believe, said NationalReview.com in an editorial. It's true the court ducked the question of whether government can force citizens to violate their religious beliefs. That issue is sure to be addressed in cases already working their way through the legal system, but this ruling was still broad enough to matter. The Colorado Civil Rights Commission is hardly alone in insisting that religious liberty claims are despicable pretext for bigotry. Virtually every progressive shares that belief. State and local governments now stand warned that hostility toward people of faith will carry a cost. We may have lost a battle in this case, but we won the war, said lawyer Dick Cole, who represents the gay couple, in WashingtonPost.com. My clients, Charlie Craig and David Mullins, simply asked for the same decorative, edible cake that Phillips would have made for a straight couple. Not a cake adorned with slogans expressing pro-gay or anti-Christian sentiments. Kennedy could not have been more clear that neither religion nor free speech justifies denying common goods and services to people based on their sexual orientation. If Craig and Mullins were to walk into Masterpiece Cake Shop tomorrow, in other words, and request a cake to celebrate their wedding anniversary, Phillips now knows he has no First Amendment right to turn them away. For that reason, the fight is far from over, said Todd Starnes in FoxNews.com. Liberals won't rest until, as Justice Clarence Thomas put it in his concurring opinion, that they stamp out every vestige of dissent on the secular redefinition of marriage. Christian conservatives won't be deterred either, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. They're waging a fierce legal campaign to get a special status enjoyed by no other group and exempt themselves from laws they find disagreeable. Given the nakedly tribal support of the current occupant of the White House, I wouldn't bet against them. This week's ruling showed there are 4 solid votes on the court for letting Christians discriminate against gays in the name of religious freedom. All they need is 1 more. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for preparation. after fashion brand Louis Vuitton hired a shaman to ensure that no rain would fall during last week's outdoor fashion show in France. No rain fell. The unidentified holy man from Brazil reportedly only travels by private jet and commands a six-figure fee for every act of weather control. It was a good week for gingers after emojis representing red-haired people were finally added to the official Unicode alphabet of emojis, thanks to lobbying from Scotland, where 13% of the population is red-haired. And it was a good week for progress after the Miss America organization scrapped the notorious swimsuit portion of the contest. "We are not going to judge you on your outward appearance," said new chairwoman Gretchen Carlson, a former Miss America and one-time Fox News host. But it was a bad week for ritual displays of patriotism. After President Trump appeared not to know the words to "God Bless America" at his hastily organized patriotic rally on the White House lawn. After singing the initial few words, Trump fell silent, bobbing his head. He resumed singing only when the words were, "God bless America." It was a bad week for the deep state after a dancing FBI agent did a backflip in a Denver bar, dropped his gun, and accidentally discharged it when he picked it up, shooting another patron in the leg. Finally, it was a bad week for citing scripture after a Florida woman arrested for DUI demanded police release her on the grounds that Jesus drank wine and so do I. Nicole Mintner, 45, later confessed to having also taken Xanax, an anti-anxiety medication not mentioned in the Bible. And while we're here, a boring but important item. McConnell cancels Senate recess. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has canceled all but 1 week of the Senate's traditional four-week August recess, in part to keep vulnerable Democrats from campaigning in their home states before the midterms. McConnell blamed the cancellation on historic obstruction by the Democrats, saying the Senate needs more time to work through a backlog of judicial and executive branch appointments. McConnell said he also hopes to make progress negotiating several spending bills. Senate Republicans and the White House both pushed McConnell for the cancellation, with 10 Democrats up for re-election in states that Trump won. McConnell did not cancel the Senate's recess in 2016, when multiple Republicans were facing difficult re-election campaigns. And we'll read a few of the items from a feature called The U.S. at a Glance. The first comes from Washington, D.C. Another EPA scandal. Scott Pruitt, the embattled EPA administrator, faced a new ethical firestorm this week amid reports that he directed a staff member to help his wife try to secure a Chick-fil-A franchise. Emails show that Pruitt directed an aide to reach out to Chick-fil-A CEO Dan Cathy to set up a meeting with his wife, Marilyn Pruitt, about becoming a franchisee. The meeting never happened, but the administrator ultimately spoke with members of Chick-fil-A's legal department, and a Chick-fil-A spokesperson confirmed that Marilyn had started but never finished a franchise application. Securing a Chick-fil-A franchise is a highly competitive process. The company receives about 40,000 expressions of interest every year, with only about 100 people selected. Pruitt also reportedly asked an aide to call the Trump International Hotel in Washington about securing a used mattress for him. This is from Brownsville, Texas. Shelter Showdown. video of immigration officials denying a U.S. senator entry to a Brownsville facility where migrant children are being held went viral on social media this week. Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon was blocked from entering a former Walmart with blacked-out windows, now serving as a shelter for children who have been separated at the border from their parents. The Attorney General's team and the Office of Refugee Resettlement don't want anyone to know what's going on behind these doors, Merkley told a responding police officer. A spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the shelters, accused Merkley of grandstanding. The number of illegal border crossings was higher than usual in May, despite the Justice Department's new zero-tolerance policy. From Richmond, Virginia, Obamacare win. Virginia's Republican-controlled legislature voted to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act last week. Roughly 400,000 low-income Virginians will gain access to the federal public health insurance program next year. The Affordable Care Act gave states the option to expand Medicaid starting in 2014, but GOP lawmakers in Virginia successfully blocked it for years. The Republican resistance began to crumble after Democrats made sweeping gains in last year's state elections, with now Governor Ralph Northam campaigning heavily on health care issues. To win Republican votes, Democrats in the State House agreed to require adults without disabilities to work or volunteer in order to receive benefits. Ultimately, enough Republicans voted for the expansion that it could have passed without any of the new Democrats who won seats in the state legislature last year. Virginia is the 33rd state to expand Medicaid under Obamacare. Parkland, Florida. Parkland survivor targeted. A police SWAT team descended on the home of Parkland survivor and prominent gun control activist David Hogg this week after a hoax 9/11 call reported that someone was in the house with a weapon. Neither Hogg nor any of his family was home at the time. The 18-year-old was in Washington, D.C. with his mother accepting a human rights award. The call was an example of swatting, in which prank callers attempt to get armed officers to raid a target's home, with potentially fatal results. Police shot and killed an unarmed 28-year-old man in Wichita in December after they were called to his home during a swatting incident. Hogg is anathema in certain gun rights circles for his pugnacious activism in response to the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, where he graduated this week. Hogg and other student activists with the March for Our Lives movement are planning a 20-state summer bus tour to campaign for gun control laws and to register young people to vote. And we'll take a pass at some of the shorter World at a Glance items. This first one comes from Berlin. Undiplomatic ambassador. The German government has asked U.S. Ambassador to Germany Richard Grenell to explain himself after he told alt-right U.S. news site Breitbart.com that he intended to empower other conservatives throughout Europe. Some politicians called for Grenell to be expelled. If a German ambassador were to say in Washington that he is there to boost the Democrats, he would have been kicked out immediately, said Martin Schulz, former head of the center-left Socialist Democrats. Grenell also upset Germans by inviting the new far-right Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, an outspoken critic of Germany's refugee policy, to lunch at the embassy, saying he was a big fan. San Miguel Los Lotes, Guatemala, volcanic eruption. At least 75 people were killed and entire towns left covered in ash after Guatemala's Fuego volcano suddenly erupted this week. Houses in the village of San Miguel Los Lotes were turned to rubble by the force of the blast. My mother's house was buried with my entire family inside, one resident told CNN. My three sons, two daughters, and my grandson. My mother, my sisters, my nieces, and nephews. Days after the eruption, the ground was so hot that it burned through firefighters' boots, and rescue workers couldn't breathe in the smoky, ashy air. Unlike the slow-moving Kilauea lava eruption in Hawaii, Fuego unleashed a deadly pyroclastic flow, a mix of ash, rock, and volcanic gases that races down a volcano's slopes at hundreds of miles per hour, far too fast for people to escape. This is from Tehran. Nuclear boost. Iran's supreme leader announced this week that he has ordered preparations to increase the country's uranium enrichment capacity if the international nuclear pact with Tehran collapses. For now, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said Iran will keep its enrichment within the limits and subject to the inspections of the 2015 deal, from which the U.S. unilaterally withdrew last month. But Khamenei said Iran will prepare for a future outside the pact if European countries fail to prevent new U.S. sanctions on European firms that do business with Iran, which will hurt the country's economy. The Iranian nation will not tolerate being under both sanctions and nuclear restrictions. France, Germany, and the U.K. have submitted a joint request to the U.S. for a sanctions exemption for EU companies. This is from Tunisia. Ramadan Hunger Games. The coach of Tunisia's national soccer team, Nabil Maloul, admitted this week that he asked the squad's goalkeeper to fake an injury during two recent World Cup warm-up games so that his players could break their Ramadan fast during the timeout. Muslims must abstain from food and drink from sunup to sundown during the holy month, even while playing professional sports. During friendly matches against Portugal and Turkey last week, Tunisian goalkeeper Moez Hassan fell to the ground at precisely sunset, and as he received medical aid, his teammates bolted to the sidelines to scarf down some sustenance. "I was hurt, bro," Hassan tweeted in French, adding laughter emojis. This from Kabul. Attack on imams. An ISIS suicide bomber struck a gathering of 3,000 senior Afghan imams in Kabul this week, shortly after the Muslim clerics had issued a fatwa prescribing suicide bombings as un-Islamic. The jihadist detonated his explosives at one of the exits from the meeting ground, killing 14 people, including 7 clerics, and wounding 17 more. The bombing was an attack against the heirs of the Prophet of Islam and the values of Islam, said Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. The clerics had also called on the Taliban to take up Ghani's offer of unconditional peace talks and declared the 17-year Afghan war illegal under Islamic law, saying it has done nothing but shed the blood of Muslims. From New Delhi, India, plastic ban. India has announced that it intends to ban all single-use plastics by 2022. The United Nations praised the plan to end the use of plastic bags, cutlery, straws, and bottles, saying that while some 60 countries have announced curbs on plastics, India's program to halt their use by more than 1.3 billion people is by far the most ambitious. The country generates about 6 million tons of plastic waste every year, much of which is dumped into the ocean and washes onto beaches. Enforcement will be difficult, 10 plastic bans are already in effect in Indian states and cities, yet only two have had significant results. But the government says it is committed. An unclean environment hurts the poor and vulnerable the most, said Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And we'll read a few of the columns now. The first is Trump's short-sighted coal plan. President Trump's bonkers strategy for reviving the coal industry could set a precedent Republicans may come to regret, said Eric Levitz. Trump wants his energy department to force utility companies to buy electric power from struggling coal and nuclear plants at uncompetitive rates, on the grounds that bailing out the declining coal industry serves a national security interest. That, of course, is patently absurd. Nearly every utility company and energy expert agrees that our energy grid, which largely depends on domestic oil, natural gas, hydro, and other U.S. sources, is perfectly stable as it is. Moreover, Trump's insistence that plans burn dirty, carbon-rich coal puts the profits of coal magnates above the survival of the planet, which is heating up fast. If this president's imperial assertion of executive power to prop up coal plants becomes a precedent, it's hard to see why a future one couldn't use it to shut them down. Imagine that Elizabeth Warren, for example, could do with the authority Trump is audaciously claiming over private companies, trade rules, and tariffs. If conservatives recoil at the thought of a future Democratic president claiming extraordinary powers to combat climate change, they should implore the current Republican to stop inventing new, extraordinary justifications for exacerbating it. This is from Italy, on a collision course with Europe. After 3 months of post-election chaos and exhausted, Italy is simply relieved to have a government at last, said Mario Calabresi in La Repubblica. But the unwieldy coalition forged last week by the far-right League, which together with allied right-leaning parties won 37% of the vote in the March election, and the pro-welfare, anti-establishment five-star movement, which took 33%, won't bring us stability. Neither party wanted the other to lead, so the prime minister is now the neutral Giuseppe Conte, 53, a law professor with no political experience. How will they govern together? A year ago, remember, five-star leaders called the League crypto-fascist, and said the two parties were genetically and culturally opposite. And the coalition agreement the two produced shows exactly that. It promises both the tax cuts the League demands and the universal basic income that Five Star campaigned on, all of which could cost this indebted nation well over $100 billion a year. Fasten your seatbelts, because this government's mixture of inexperience, improvisation, and arrogance will lead us on a wild and possibly dangerous ride. This divided government is a perfect representation of a divided nation, said Pierre Cyril Hacour in Le Monde. Italy's rich industrial north, which voted for the League, has a booming economy and resents the waves of unskilled African migrants who have flowed to Italy in recent years. The more rural South, which voted for Five Star, has a poor, poorly educated, and jobless society, and its people blame their ills on the introduction of the euro in 1999. The split between the two Italies has existed since Italian unification in the late 19th century, but has worsened in the past decade. This instability threatens the entire European Union, said Ulrich Landerner in Die Zeit. If one room in a shared apartment goes up in flames, surely all the other roommates should shout fire. Yet criticizing Italy's political insanity only makes Italians resent the EU even more. In fact, the EU is an excellent scapegoat for Italy's new government, said Italian journalist Roberto Saviano in The Guardian. If Conte can't deliver the League's flat tax or 5 stars basic income, EU budget rules will be blamed. Italians voted in this populist government out of an anger at their national leaders' ineptitude. The populace can now channel that rage at an external target. At least this new coalition is taking action on the immigration crisis, said Anna Sampino in Giornale di Sicilia from Italy. As soon as he was sworn in as interior minister, League leader Matteo Salvini traveled to Sicily, a major landing area for African and other migrants, 120,000 of whom crossed the Mediterranean to Italy last year. Salvini declared that he would build on the previous government's policies of control, removal, and expulsion, and demanded that the EU share the burden. Italy, he said, cannot be transformed into a refugee camp on behalf of Europe. This is a How They See Us international column. Trump's tariffs anger U.S. allies. The U.S. has just declared war, said Martin Kettle in The Guardian. President Donald Trump's decision to slap a 25% tariff on all steel imported from Canada, Mexico, and the European Union, and a 10% duty on imported aluminum is an act of aggression against America's closest allies. Free trade has bound the nations of the West together for more than half a century, but this attack marks a turning point. It declares us America's enemies. The tariffs are so hurtful as to be incomprehensible, said the Globe and Mail from Canada in an editorial. To evade World Trade Organization strictures, the U.S. president invoked national security as the reason for his erratic and irresponsible decision. As Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said while announcing retaliatory duties on U.S. goods, ranging from ballpoint pens to toilet paper to maple syrup, that suggestion is an affront to the thousands of Canadians who have fought and died alongside American comrades in arms. Trudeau also pointed out that the U.S. has a $2 billion surplus in steel trade with Canada. But since Trump is entirely immune to reason, invoking facts is useless. Trump cares about one thing only: enriching his family, said Scott Gilmore in Maclean's from Canada. Countries get what they want from him through bribery. China granted his daughter Ivanka trademarks, and a Qatar-linked company is investing in son-in-law Jared Kushner's real estate. The smart retaliation, then, would be to target Trump's family businesses. Canada could levy a special tax on Trump properties. The EU could revoke visas for Trump Organization employees, and the UK could close his golf courses. It sounds like satire, but then so does the idea of a U.S. president dismantling the entire liberal international order because he is focused on promoting his own interests at the expense of American allies and at the expense of Americans themselves. Trump is just facing reality, said Dmitry Lekur in RIA Novosti from Russia. The U.S. trade deficit grew nearly 13% to $568 billion last year. If that trend continues and the U.S. continues to buy more than it sells to the world, the American economy will simply die. Unlike past presidents, Trump is determined to selfishly work in the interest of the national economy and not that of globalist financial circles. Other countries will have to do the same. The age of globalization is over. American international leadership is dead, said Jean-Marc Vittori in Les Echos from France. but free trade lives. The huge trade treaty known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership is steaming ahead despite Trump's pullout. And the world's top economies are quietly discussing creating new trade mechanisms for the post-U.S. era. China's new Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank has 64 member countries, a third of them European. And unlike the U.S., with the World Bank, China doesn't have a veto. The world won't let the seeds of discord planted by the U.S. president germinate and grow. Read one of the obituaries this week. This is the restaurateur who became a New Orleans icon. Ella Brennan, 1925 to 2018. Ella Brennan made every meal a celebration. The matriarch of a family of New Orleans restaurateurs, Brennan spent half a century running the Klan's flagship, Commander's Palace, which is famed for serving a mix of Nouvelle, Creole, and Cajun cuisines with a theatrical flourish. At Commander's, balloons decorate tables, diners wear chef's hats, and local musicians parade from table to table. "I don't want a restaurant where a jazz band can't come marching through," Brennan said. The food was no afterthought, and although Brennan didn't cook, she groomed chefs who became stars and obsessively refined the menu, adding acclaimed dishes including turtle soup au sherry and bananas Foster. Brennan could be tough. Her nickname was Hurricane Ella, but she was as devoted to the staff as she was demanding. "What I do is teach," she said. "I've been doing it forever." Brennan was born in New Orleans to a shipyard superintendent father and a homemaker mother who was an inventive cook, said the New Orleans Times-Picayune. After graduating from high school, she began overseeing operations at the family's new Bourbon Street restaurant, Vieux Carré. The menu was dull, trout, chicken, and veal, and following her repeated complaints, her eldest brother Owen declared, "You think you're so smart? Go fix it, smarty pants." Brennan added Creole staples and taught the servers and herself about wine. The restaurant prospered. But as they prepared to move into a larger space in 1955, Owen died of a heart attack. A family feud developed with his widow, said the New York Times, and Brennan was eventually ousted from the restaurant. She refused to return for 40 years. In 1969, Brennan and a sister, Adelaide, bought a rundown eatery called Commander's Palace, said the Washington Post. With a focus on local ingredients and an amazing streak of chefs, Paul Prudhomme, Emeril Lagasse, Jamie Shannon, the restaurant went on to win 6 James Beard Awards, the Oscars of the food world. When Hurricane Katrina struck in 2005, Commander suffered considerable damage. Repairs took 13 months and $6.5 million to complete. And when the restaurant reopened in 2006, Brennan and her co-workers were greeted with cheers in the packed dining room. "We never even paused to consider not coming back," she said. "Hell no. New Orleans is our town, and she needed us as much as we needed her." And we are on the business page, the news at a glance. Looks like we'll probably finish out today's show on this page. Starting with tech. Facebook under fire again on privacy. Facebook was back on the defensive this week after reports that it provided users' data to at least 60 phone companies globally, including Huawei, a telecom giant with alleged ties to the Chinese government, said Tony Rahm in the Washington Post. The data sharing agreements, which date to 2007, were part of an effort by Facebook to attract more mobile users. The company gave phone manufacturers direct access to Facebook data so that devices could incorporate the like button and other popular Facebook features, and so that customers could more seamlessly perform tasks such as syncing their contacts. Some partners, the list included Apple, HTC, and Samsung, could access users' work history, relationship status, and political leanings, as well as the data of their users' friends. Certainly, it looks bad for Facebook to have made and kept these agreements, said Alexis Madrigal in TheAtlantic.com. Although there is so far no evidence of data misuse, Huawei has been flagged by U.S. intelligence as a national security threat. And it is troubling that Facebook did not initially acknowledge that Chinese firms were part of the data sharing agreements. Their reticence adds to the sense expressed by congressional leaders and just about everyone else that maybe Facebook is not always completely forthcoming about its problems. 1918 views on corporate directors. A British survey of investigating the lack of women on UK corporate boards received a few cringeworthy excuses from some of the country's top executives, said Arnie Tsang in the New York Times. All the good women have already been snapped up, was one tone-deaf response, as were, we have one woman already on the board, so we are done, and most women don't want the hassle or pressure. Overall, about a quarter of the board members at Britain's 350 biggest public companies are women. There has been some progress. The number of all-male boards among firms in the FTSE 350 stock index has fallen to just 10 companies in the last year, from 152 in 2011. Still, the survey responses illustrate that much remains to be done. Reading the executives' excuses, you might think it's 1918, not 2018, Amanda McKenzie, chief executive of the charity Business in the Community, said. It reads like a script from a comedy parody. Execs. Schultz ends four-decade run at Starbucks. Starbucks Executive Chairman Howard Schultz announced this week he is stepping down at the end of June, said Zlati Meyer in USA Today. Schultz joined the Seattle-based coffee chain in 1982 when it had just four stores, and as CEO beginning in 1986, shepherded it into a global heavyweight with more than 28,000 outposts in 77 countries. The 64-year-old, who handed off his CEO duties to Kevin Johnston in April last year, plans to write a book on Starbucks' social impact work and consider whether to pursue a rumored run for elected office. Media. British regulators approve Fox's Sky deal. After 16 months of deliberation, UK regulators said this week that 21st Century Fox can proceed with its bid for control of the British satellite broadcasting giant Sky, said Michael de la Merced in the New York Times. The approval of the deal, which is predicated on Fox selling Sky News, the broadcaster's 24-hour news channel, is likely a prelude to a bidding war over Sky and to a larger fight. Disney is trying to purchase Fox, which already owns part of Sky and has offered to buy the rest. But Comcast is attempting to play spoiler, bidding for both Fox and Sky, all with the goal of causing trouble for Disney. Retail. Lord & Taylor Landmark to permanently closed. Looking for another sign of how tough it is in the retail world? Fashion conglomerate Hudson's Bay is shuttering Lord & Taylor's century-old Manhattan flagship early next year, along with 10 other Lord & Taylor stores. Although WeWork purchased the landmark site last year, Hudson's Bay held an option to lease several floors for Lord & Taylor, but will now decline. The company this week also offloaded the once-hot website chain Gilt Group, owner of Gilt.com, which it purchased for $250 million in 2016. It had already written down the acquisition by $116 million. And a few short notes in the bottom line. The share of U.S. homeowners who are underwater on their mortgages dipped below 10% last year for the first time since the housing crash, according to Zillow. Just 4.5 million homeowners, or 9.1% of the total, owed more on their mortgages than their houses were worth, down from 15.7 million, or 31.4%, in early 2012. Medicare's trust fund will become insolvent in 2026, 3 years earlier than expected. Social Security's trust fund will be depleted in 2034. This year, Social Security's cost will exceed its income for the first time since 1982. And finally, Microsoft has replaced Google's parent company, Alphabet, as the world's third most valuable company, behind Apple and Amazon. We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.